Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. This week, we're going to speak with director Michael Gracey about a couple of spots he did for T-Mobile for Saatchi & Saatchi in the UK. You may have seen these. They were pretty popular viral spots on the internet as well as being commercials over there. The first one takes place in the Liverpool train station. Hundreds of dancers, a lot of cameras, people dancing different song snippets. Very popular spot. I'm sure you've seen. If not, we'll put a link to it in the story. And then the most recent one that just came out was a cast of thousands singing karaoke Hey Jude in Trafalgar Square. These kind of spots present a whole lot of production challenges. It's not as much a visual effects challenge as it is production challenges, how to shoot in these large public spaces and getting all the permissions and clever solutions they had to come up with for cameras and making it look genuine. So I think you'll enjoy that. Before we get to that interview, I wanted to talk a little bit about NAB. We had a great time in Vegas, and hopefully our FX Guide TV episodes and podcast from the meetup we did helped you if you couldn't make it to the show this year. Best part for us was we also got to meet so many of our postgrads from our FX PhD training site. It was just great to have to get to meet those people and hang out and have a little time to chat with them. Speaking of FX PhD, the term is underway, and you can still join up. And seriously, I know I'm biased, but I've got to say it's shaping up to be just one of the best terms ever. Those of you who've been following closely know that we did a bunch of shots, 262 shots for the Red Dwarf sci-fi show. The effects were done by postgrads, by myself, by Mike Seymour, by a team called Special Ops that we put together in FX PhD last term. Well, what's really cool about this, and the reason we did it, was to get the production footage. So for the first time, we're able to do behind the scenes. We're able to show stuff on set. We're able to give the students footage from the actual production. And this has been the dream for us. We've obviously provided footage to the postgrad since the beginning of the of FX PhD, but we've had to shoot that and come up with similar to production scenarios, other than a couple of short films that we did for Sundance that made it to Sundance. Anyway, it's a real access backstage. Mike Seymour was the visual effects supervisor on the show, so you really get his perspective on what he took to the set with him. For example, was the show I was just watching, the most recent class I was just watching in the Background Fundamentals class, which comes along with everybody's membership when you sign up for FX PhD. Anyway, I just think it's really, people have been screaming for actual production experience, actual production things. So being able to work through the classes and see how an actual production handled the job in the various classes, I think is very exciting. So we're very excited about it. If you get a chance, go over to FX PhD and check it out. Anyway, let's jump in now with Mike Seymour talking to Michael Gracey about these T-Mobile spots.
Michael Gracey, my friend, how are you, sir?
I'm brilliant, Mike.
Thanks for joining in to talk to us.
Oh, of course.
Now, as
I'm Mike Seymour. I'll agree to anything.
As I'm talking to you now, it must be at least 2 or 3 a.m. in London, and you're in an edit suite, is that right?
That's right. I'm in an edit suite here in Soho. And we are doing a cut of the T-Mobile commercial that we shot the other day.
So I wanted to talk to you about the T-Mobile campaign because it's just an extraordinary piece of advertising and just almost performance art. Let's start with the original one, which was the train station spot as part of the Life's for Sharing campaign. So how did that first... Is that the first spot? Is that the one that started it all?
That was the first spot. I mean, I was really fortunate in that Saatchi & Saatchi got me in really early. And the two creatives, Steve Howe and Rick Dodds, they approached me and said, you know, look, we're doing something that involves dance and that's your thing, so let's talk about a whole bunch of ideas. Like there was references to, a wide variety of things. And you know, I had my laptop with me and I showed them a concept that I'd done for a video clip, which was for a track called I Want to Go Back. And the idea was that I wanted to do a video clip where the dance style changed every 10 seconds all the way through the music clip. And along with their dance styles changing, their costumes changed as well, but it was all done seamlessly. And so, like, they'd be performing with top hats, and they'd throw their top hats in the air and spin around, and as they spun, the outfit would change, but the top hat that would then come down into shot would be a tambourine, and they'd catch that, and then they'd go into the next dance style. So this was, you know, the point being that the dance style started with current dance styles, and it worked its way back through history, you know, all the way back to sort of black and white top hat and tails. And it sort of then became obvious that in a very short space of time, you can see a change in dance style. Like 10 seconds seems like a very quick amount of time, but when you're dancing, you can immediately recognize these changes. So we then looked at doing sort of 10-second sound bites of songs that we thought would make an amazing compilation of dancing. And, you know, we brought in Ashley Wallen, who's only the world's greatest choreographer, who you've worked with as well, Mike.
Just amazing. Just, I mean, and not only the choreography is great, but to actually see him dance is just a treat.
Yeah, completely. So that was brilliant to bring Ashley in. And it was one of those things, look, you know, some of the best work you get to do as a director is when creatives call you in really early in on a project and you get to actually have input. And, you know, Rick and Steve are kind of, you know, they're incredibly confident and incredibly brilliant at what they do. And so with that confidence, they're very open to sharing ideas, you know, and that to me is, as a director, you know, you can have creatives who dictate exactly what they want you to do. And as a director, that's really limiting. And you never give your best in those situations because you're just constricted. And then you have creatives like these guys. And not only, you know, is it about the front end. I mean, you know, they're still here in two suites away from me at, you know, 3 a.m. And they were here, you know, all through the editorial process of dance, you know, where we worked, you know, for 48 hours straight to deliver. So that was something else that came out of these campaigns, whereas because the world exists now and we knew we were onto something because when we started rehearsing, and we were rehearsing with 300 dancers, and we would rehearse in Liverpool Street Station, which is where it took place, between the hours of 12 midnight and 5 a.m., and when there was no trains running. But there were still workmen who were working on the train lines, and there were still a few people drifting in and out of the station, and we couldn't officially lock it down and stop people from coming in and out. So people did wander in and out. And the first thing that anyone does in today's society when they see something out of the ordinary is pull out their mobile phone and either take a photo or take a video of what's in front of them.
And send it to their mates.
Just, and send it. Like, it is kind of, it's the default thing for anything that you see these days that is out of the ordinary. So in terms of a mobile phone campaign, what Rick and Steve came up with was completely 100% on the money. You know what I mean? Like, we sort of realized at that point, even at the rehearsals, that every single person who stopped and saw what they did, which was, you know, 300 people dancing, would get out their mobile phone and flick it up and either take a photo or record a video, at which point we'd have to run over to them and say, hey, listen, please don't put this up on YouTube and please don't send these, you know, and put them up on Flickr. We just need to keep this under wraps for another 2 nights. And it was fantastic. When they first pitched the concept of people spontaneously dancing, you know, one of the visions that I had was obviously Terry Gilliam's Fisher King.
I was going to say, it's a bit like Flash Mob crossed with Fisher King, isn't it, really?
Yeah, but I mean, like, Flash Mob is just, you know, the idea of doing something spontaneously, you know, and they do it brilliantly well, but there's nothing new about that idea. I mean, you didn't look at the sequence in, you know, Terry Gilliam's Fisher King and go, oh, what a great example of flash mobs.
No, no,
you know
no.
what I mean? Like,
and
that's just a cinematic moment, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's a magical moment in Fisher King. It's just...
Yeah, and it's, you know, they don't sort of, they don't have, you know, rights on spontaneity. I mean, spontaneity is one of those wonderful things that exists throughout all time in humanity where people just do things in the moment. And for me, you know, that was one of the most beautiful things. I love Terry Gilliam's film, Fisher King, and I love the opportunity of recreating that sensation of, you know, a whole train station all of a sudden just joining together and starting to waltz.
But I think the other great thing about it is you can just see in the faces of the crowd, and for that matter, anyone that watches the actual spot on the web, everyone just smiles. It's just it's like a heartwarming thing to see.
Yeah, and look, to be honest, the British public did themselves proud, because I was saying from the very beginning, being Australian, listen, you know, the British are very conservative. I'm not really sure they're going to go for this like you think they will. You know, like, we should be doing this in New York, where people will jump in and join in and, you know, we'll get an amazing response. But to their credit, the British public just went for it. Like, they went for it in such a way that that train station, Liverpool Street Station, has complaints every single day, 7 days a year, from the general public about the bins being smelly, about, you know, signs being in the way when they're trying to walk, any number of things that people come up with. That day, when we did and disrupted people's movements, but did so with a dance that you know, made people smile, that day they had not one complaint.
It's just extraordinary.
And that to me was the magic of the moment. It really was an incredible moment to stand there and look out at all these people spontaneously dancing and the general public joining in. And that was kind of the rule. You know, the dancers were told, look, it's not about you putting on a performance. It's all about you getting the general public involved. So as you're starting to dance, grab a member of the general public. And that was the whole point. The reason that the waltz came in the middle was that people had enough time to spot the people who had been tapping their foot and smiling or bobbing up and down. And that was the person at that moment that they had to turn to and ask them to dance with them. And so from that moment on, we doubled in numbers. Like, in that instant that everyone did the waltz, all of a sudden, all these members of general public, and we signed 1,227 release forms.
Holy dilly. there was what, 300 dancers, but there was 1,200 people dancing by the end? Is that right?
Yeah, wow. By the end, yeah. So the you know, that was kind of it. And to be interested, like, one of the interesting things I found from it was that my greatest fear is that it was going to be like when you went to see Prince live, and it is the most incredible performance. And when you're there and the people are cheering and Prince is singing, you're like, this is the greatest concert ever. And then you go home and tell everyone about it, and then the DVD comes out and you bring everyone over to your house and you play them the DVD. But it's nothing like the experience of what it was to be there. You know what I mean? Like, that is always one of the greatest things of trying to capture a moment. And Andy at 750 miles per hour, which is the sound company here in London, he did the best job, because what he did was he had all of his mics set up to record all of that ambient sound and all of the cheering and all of the people singing along. And when you fed that in, all of a sudden it went from being a video clip to being live. It just had that live sensation like it was when you were there.
Okay, so it was actually not going for perfect sound of the track, but going for more the ambience of the people that brought it to
completely.
Life.
Completely.
Right.
You know, and the people going whoop, and people, you know, yelling out comments and laughing, and everything that it was to be there was captured. And so it was very interesting for me, because I was like, you know, we had the head of, you know, Saatchi and Saatchi there. We had the heads of T-Mobile fly in. I mean, the head of T-Mobile flew in from Germany, and he actually ran down on to the floor and started dancing. Like, that's how much he got carried away in the moment.
Getting your client's client to start spontaneously dancing is not something that normally happens in advertising.
No. It was just fantastic. So, look, that really played well. It went on to have a life on the internet. You know, I think it had something like 13 million hits.
Can I ask you some of the logistics around it? Because clearly it looks like it evolved out at one session. But was it filmed in one session?
No, it was filmed in multiple sessions. And we cut it to make it look like it was one session. But to be completely honest, it's kind of taken from only two of those takes. So what happened is, we ran it in the morning. We promised the station we wouldn't run it more than three times. if you couldn't even imagine the health and safety of trying to stage something in the general public. It is like, it was published in volumes, the forms that we had to get signed. You know, it was just incredible. I've never attended meetings like that, that just went on forever and ever and ever. And it was about, you know, every subsurface, you know, approval form, and the fire department and the police department and the, you know, all of these different things that you have to square away to stage an event like this was just out of control.
And just to be really clear about this, because say somebody's being cynical, you never actually took over the station and shut down trains. You never took over the station and shut down normal operations. And you never took over the station at night when there were no trains and pretended like it was in the middle of the day. This actually happened effectively for real.
Yeah, completely. And I mean, look, you, what's interesting is, you know, not one of our 300 people have a close-up in that commercial. Because the magic was in the people who joined in spontaneously. And that was the whole point of the commercial. And when you shoot those faces and when you capture those genuine moments, and that's what we're really going for, is genuine moments. When you capture those genuine moments, you cannot, as a director, ever, ever ask someone to act that.
And also,
never get that. Once the moment someone's acting it, it's a performance. None of those moments were a performance. And that's why it resonates with people, because you're looking at people who are responding in the most natural and honest way to what is unfolding in front of them.
So, again, you weren't sort of standing on the side with a megaphone yelling, you know, cut and let's play that track again. You were, like, literally setting the thing in motion and then sitting back, presumably in some hidden spot with some video feeds.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We had we took over two of the shop fronts, and we had 11 cameras. We shot on different formats. We shot on RED. We shot on the SI2K cameras, which they shot quite a bit of Slumdog Millionaire on. Mm-hmm. Running into laptops in backpacks. So they were disguised as SLRs. We hollowed out bodies of Nikons and fed the SI2K camera into the body of the Nikon, so it just looked like a standard SLR camera. And then up on the concourse, shooting down, we were on ARRI D21s.
Yeah, D21, right, yep.
Yeah, the ARRI D21s. So that was sort of, you know, in itself was an amazing pipeline, because the thing was that we knew that once we staged this, and so to get back to your original question, we shot it in the morning, and we shot it about five times, and we kind of were just like, you know what, the station's not a buzz enough, and we really wanted more people, and what we'd do is we'd shoot it, and then we'd leave it like 20 minutes or half an hour so that there was an entire turnover in the station so that, you know, we weren't running the same thing.
And you'd had someone actually time out what was going on in the station to give you your effectively 3-minute windows, right?
Yeah, we had to shoot a time lapse of the entire day to work out where we were going to shoot. But then we had to have some poor runner at Partizan, which was the production company. And Partizan are gods. They just do the most incredible productions. I mean, I look at work on the TV and think that's incredible, and then I find out it's done by Partizan. You know, like,
it's one of the world's great production companies.
Yeah, and so they had someone go down and sit there and have to record in between the announcements so that we could find our 3-minute windows over the course of the entire day, because we couldn't adjust the announcements. Those announcements and those train times we could obviously not alter. And we couldn't play music over the top of those announcements, so we had to map out in the course of a day what 3-minute slots fell in between announcements that we could pick off. And basically what happened is we ran it, and then we sort of broke for lunch, and we spoke to the camera operators and sort of said, this is working, this isn't working. And, you know, one of the real things we found was that people crowd the plate. Like, when you have a camera, people kind of stand back from it, you know, because they don't want to stand right in front of a lens. Mm-hmm. But when they're all hidden cameras, which they were, they're all in bags and under people's arms or disguised as just still cameras, and an event takes place, everyone just goes to the event. So then a cameraman just had shots of backs of heads and backs of people. And so then they push to the front, but then by the time they push to the front, their lens is smack bang in front of a dancer who's standing a meter away from them. You know, like, we had these real issues trying to shoot and get in amongst the action without standing on top of the dancers, you know.
Yeah, without choreographing the crowd, yeah.
Exactly. And this is the thing about any of these live events. You have to be really organic. You have to have great operators. And what we ended up doing is we sort of had a spotter system where a spotter would go down with the cameraman. So while the cameraman was shooting the person that was a great performance, the spotter's then looking for something else that's naturalistic or real and turning the camera operator so that he can now capture something else. Because otherwise you get a whole lot of nothing. You get a camera operator who's maybe focused on something good, but the whole time they're scanning to find something else that's good, and so they'll just drift off that person that may be doing something great,
right, right,
and then drift onto something else. But, you know, they don't have the confidence to just stay there and focus on that one moment because they're panicked that they're missing another moment that could possibly be happening right next to them.
And also, from an editorial point of view, you need coverage of the entire piece. You can't just say, well, we've got really great waltz footage and nothing for the music that comes after it, kind of thing. You know, it has to be well, you have to have good coverage right throughout.
Completely. So, I mean, what ended up happening is I got frustrated sitting in the shop front looking at the feeds from the cameras. And so I ran down, and there's actually a shot, because Diesel, who cut it, also was shooting it. He was one of the 11 cameramen. So there's a shot of me and Diesel standing in the middle of all of this dancing and me pushing him around to get another shot. And that actually gets caught on one of the cameras. But we're tiny, fortunately.
Hey, I think you were alluding to this before and I cut you off, so I want to get back to it. I think you were about to say that you didn't have a lot of time to actually then pull all this together in post. Was that right?
Yeah, so we had 11 cameras. We ran it 11 times. So you can do the math on that.
A lot of footage.
A lot of footage. And then we had to process, obviously, the SI2K material and the RED material and get it all back onto Sony tapes, which are the SR HD tapes. And then we had to digitize those, and then we had to cut. And then we had to get a cut approved and ClearCast, which is where you have to get your material approved by the government to put it to air. And we had to do all of this and deliver 24 hours after the event.
Now, by my maths, as you said it then, even if you only buttoned on and buttoned off at the very beginning and end of the song, you'd have had at least 6.5 hours to digitize in just to start the offline. And if you only had 24 hours, you've already lost a quarter of that just getting the footage into an Avid. So,
yeah, well, even more than that. We actually cut on Final Cut.
Okay.
And we had two editors, Ben Harricks and Diesel, and both on Final Cut, and we were just... It was one of the most surreal things because we were cutting so fast, mainly because we live in a world of YouTube where people flip open their phones, they shoot videos, they upload them on YouTube. So if we had to spend the usual post process of 2 weeks, by the time we got something out, it was old news. People had already seen it, watched it maybe a dozen times on YouTube. You know, so then when you see the official commercial, you're like, yeah, but that happened 2 weeks ago.
Did it make the actual news, like the nightly news kind of news?
It made the nightly news, yeah. And then someone actually put a Facebook group together and recreated it. And they went down and did a more traditional flash mob. 13 people showed up and they had to close down the station.
Right. Did you just say that happened? 1,300 that, or 13,000 people turned up?
13,000 people showed up.
Wow.
And they had to shut down the station. And if you look at those end shots that are in our commercial, there is like 1,300 people in those shots, so you can only imagine what 13,000 people was like.
Now, all of this was, of course, phenomenally successful, and I was with you in London at dinner right after you'd done this, and I was stunned at how cool this was. But after dinner, I remember thinking to myself, I wonder how you'd ever top that again, because once you'd done it, you couldn't do it again. And also, the concept of doing something like that, it works at so many levels. I mean, it's free advertising. It talk about feel good for a brand. And, you know, generally, it's just innovative, and you get so much mileage that you're not having to buy on television, even though, of course, there were TV ads. But you did come up with a sequel, and that's the Hey Jude spot, right?
Yeah. Well, it's called Sing Along. And again, Rick and Steve, the same creatives, came back with this idea of like, well, look, we've done dancing, now let's do singing. That's the other great thing that people do when they go out at night is karaoke. You know, let's get people having the feel-good factor from standing there and just belting out, you know, their favorite tunes. And so we went back to the music and compiled our favorite, you know, karaoke songs. And it was interesting because we just, after dance, we sort of, you know, there was record labels who'd be calling, you know, from the States saying to their sync reps, you know, why weren't any of our songs on that YouTube hit, you know, T-Mobile Dance, like, and we did approach a lot of people, and a lot of people said no to using a lot of really famous tracks.
So,
but all of a sudden, with Sing Along, we just had this, all these people were letting us, you know, work with their songs because of the way that dance had evolved into, you know, something more than just a commercial.
Because in fact, some of the songs were only approved for the dance at the last minute, weren't they?
Yeah, actually, Pussycat Dolls was the night before, Pussycat Dolls wasn't approved, which meant that Ashley had to have multiple routines for the choreography in case we lost that song.
Now, Sing Along is obviously the Hey Jude. It's like it's one of the most iconic Beatles songs, and most, you know, to a generation, one of the most known songs. Was it easy to pick Hey Jude, or was it there's a short list of, and it was a tough call?
No, it was sort of the ultimate. We were like, if we can get Hey Jude, it's the one song that everyone can sing. Even if you're not a confident singer, you're going to get involved in the na na na's. You know, it's just, it's got everything that, you know, it's kind of, it's a classic join in song. And you know, what was funny is that when it was airing, the creatives went over to the pub across the road from where we were cutting it, and just to watch it. And they asked the guy behind the bar to just, you know, turn up the TV. And in the pub, everyone started singing along with it.
Wow.
As they were watching the commercial for the first time. That was when it went to air for the first time. So it sort of, you know, Hey Jude is just a great track. And that's not to say, you know, there's some other amazing performances, which we're now cutting into other commercials, because we ran like 7-8 songs.
Oh, okay.
Just so that people didn't show up and only get to sing out one song. You know, we wanted to sort of make a bit of a, you know, a bit of an afternoon of it, really,
but
at Trafalgar Square.
Did you play Hey Jude more than once?
We did, actually. We played the first couple of bars of it, or more than the first couple of bars. We played the first couple of verses, but we didn't hit the chorus as a warm-up.
Okay.
And that was because we wanted to get shots of people still hesitant about joining in and singing.
Right.
Because after 7 songs, no one's hesitant. Everyone's lost their inhibition. Everyone's singing their guts out. But from a cinematic point of view, it was really beautiful to have those moments where people are still testing their mics. You know, there's this great moment where this little girl goes into her microphone before she starts singing, just to make sure she can hear herself before she goes to the trouble of singing.
I guess the question was it easier to get permission to do Trafalgar Square after dance, or was it still just a nightmare?
No, it was still very difficult. We were working in with Pink's schedule as well, because Pink makes an appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And she obviously was out here for her concert, but we only had a window of one day where she could possibly do this. So we were working with that, which meant that the production period literally was 2 weeks from the job getting the go-ahead to the day we were shooting was 2 weeks.
Oh, my God. I couldn't even imagine putting a normal shoot on in 2 weeks, let alone something of this magnitude. How many cameras and what was sort of stats on how you did it?
It was 22 cameras, 24 cameras, actually. Again, same combination of cameras, but not the SI2Ks because they overheated during dance and we lost quite some valuable takes. So we went to a camera called the Iconics. Mm-hmm. And we there's actually a shot in there off a Nikon D90. Just because someone in the crowd had one and showed it to us afterwards, and the editor said, yeah, give me your card. And they went, what? And he went, seriously, give me your card. And so there's a shot of a little kid singing on his parents' shoulders, and that's off a Nikon D90. Most everything else is either Red, Iconics, or any of the shots from rooftops are on the Arri D21s. And
so how did you get the 13,500 people to Trafalgar Square?
13,500. Again, just sort of, you know, Facebook. T-Mobile sent out a text message to its users who were in the right, you know, zone. Some flyers on the day. A lot of people had emailed after dance saying, if you're doing this again, can you please let me know? And both Partisan and Saatchi & Saatchi had kept a database of these people. So they just, you know, basically did a mass email out to let everyone know what was going on.
But did you have to like, and then it was just get release word forms from these people? Or was it just like...
We had to get release forms. We had to put up big signs explaining what we were doing. But it was a bit different this time because this time people knew they were coming for a commercial.
Right.
Which changed the dynamic completely in that in the last commercial, we didn't have anyone spotting the cameras. And in this commercial, all we had was people looking for the cameras.
Right.
And so you got people who literally, whenever the camera came close to them, just screamed and screamed and screamed at the camera.
Right.
You know, I mean, we could make the most incredible zombie film just by widening our eyes. Because it is kind of horrifying, the amount of people screaming at camera. But that said, it was a different thing. The spontaneity wasn't the fact that people showed up. The spontaneity in this is the fact that no one knew they were going to be singing. And so we just handed out 2,000 microphones.
How many of those did you get back?
Not many of them at all. Yeah, a lot of people, including people at the agency, were boasting that they'd stolen microphones.
Okay. So where were the 2,000 mics feeding? Like, just a logistical problem there for a second. These 2,000 radio mics?
They were feeding... out of them, there was 200 radio mics, which meant that it even limited the channels we could have to talk to our cameramen. Britannia Rowe did the sound. They do a lot of live concert sound, and they were like, this is just completely out of control, guys. And then we had the 24 cameras coming into a truck where we had a bank of monitors, and then I was directing, but because the sound of the people was so loud, the cameraman could hardly hear what I was yelling, so at multiple times I would run out of the truck and run into the crowd to try and direct. You know, it was mayhem. It was amazing. Too many people showed up, so they actually stopped people entering the square. So quite a lot of people, like literally thousands of people, couldn't get into the square because of health and safety again. That was with no one knowing that Pink was going to be popping up and, you know, doing some numbers.
What sort of makes this, as obviously now is evident from your first discussion, is that the mics allowed you to get the voices of an individual as opposed to just the crowd chanting, which...
Completely. And
really
it made it really intimate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it made it really intimate. And it's really beautiful because you can cut to these wide shots and get this crowd of noise, but then you can cut down and just literally pick up, because if you look carefully, all those mics are color-coded and numbered, and you can get the really intimate performance of someone just singing into a microphone. you know, and it's just beautiful. Like, it was, you know, it was just wonderful being able to pick these shots and then say, can we listen to the audio of, you know, Green 74, you know?
Now, on some, you know, of those shots of the wide shots, like, there's about 2.5 minutes in, there's a wide shot, looks like a crane shot, that, and that's just completely, there's none of this is altered, right? That's just a completely, that's how saturated the crowd was.
Oh, yeah, no, there's no post. There's no time for post. I mean, again, this one was turned around in 48 hours, not 24 hours. But it's still, that was just literally due to the number of cameras and footage we had. We had 36 hours of footage, and we delivered it 36 hours after we finished shooting.
Cripes.
So this one we cut on Avid, not on Final Cut, purely because we cut at Final Cut, ironically, an Avid setup here in Soho. And it meant that we could have four suites all digitizing at the same time into a single server that all suites could then access. So, again, Diesel and Ben Harricks were cutting, but it just meant that we could load in on four separate suites off the HDSR Sony DeX. And it meant that we obviously got times, you know, four times real time in. But, you know, even that is crazy to say. You know, we literally had only just finished going through all the rushes, you know, a few hours before we had to deliver a final cut.
And so Hey Jude is the first of several ads we'll get to see with the crowd singing. Is that what you're saying before? Or?
That's right, yeah. So what we're cutting now in the background that you can hear is Pink singing Another Piece of My Heart by Janis Joplin.
Wow.
Take another piece of my heart.
And tell me, what was the vibe like? Was the crowd, because they knew it was now an advertisement and it was less, you know, like they were less, you know, caught in an off-guarded moment. Was the crowd still, like, in a really good mood? Was the crowd as, you know, your compliments?
That was an amazing mood. I mean, look, it's really bizarre. When you look at these shots, you're like, you've got, you know, mums, you've got grandparents, you've got kids, you've got hip-hop gang guys, and they're all there singing away, like, you know, just so happy. You know, like, for whatever people can be cynical about, you know, you get post people saying, you know, don't forget, it's just advertising, you know, they're just brainwashing you and all the rest of it. You know, like, advertising. Like, you know, we all know the purpose of it. But at the end of the day, these people, you know, for a moment, are bringing people together, and they're making a huge difference. You know, like, they really do, they really put a smile on people's faces. And at the moment, with everything that's going on, and financially, the position that a lot of people are in, you know, there's something to be said for a company that's ambition is life for sharing. You know, and they actively go out and put on these event commercials, if you will, to bring that message across, and they do it, you know, wonderfully well. And it's an incredible atmosphere to walk around. Even after the event, people were just walking down the street, arm in arm, just singing na 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 na. I mean, these are complete strangers.
Wow. And yet, your team must have been, in both cases, completely exhausted, because this would be like, you know, an around-the-clock complete commitment. I mean, people like Diesel you're talking about were shooting and then editing. I mean, your team must have been incredible. How many people do you actually sort of have on a job like this?
Well, Partisan has, both of these were produced by Russell Curtis at Partisan, who is phenomenal, and he's technical, and he's brilliant, and he ticks all the boxes, and he's incredibly thorough, and he's, you know, he's the sort of the rock that you need. So, you know, that's, you know, that's on the Partisan front. You've got, you know, Russell. And then on the first one, we had Max Milan, and on production managing. And then on this one, we had Bonnie Anthony. And Ed Sayers is the producer from the agency front. And Ed Sayers is just incredible. So between, you know, Ed and Russell, and Bonnie and Max, we've just had incredible production people who have literally commanded a cast of hundreds of production people, of runners, getting clearance forms, getting photographs, getting signatures. You know, it's you know, we're handed clearance books that literally are as thick as encyclopedias, and there's 20 people's pictures every page.
And I guess the thing about this is that, and, you know, one sort of, when you're talking about this, it's easy to sort of think a ton of red tape getting in the way of something fun. But if you just flip it around for a second, if something went wrong at one of these events, if there wasn't adequate crowd control, if it was a nightmare, that would come back and rebound on the brand and be devastatingly negative because it's such a public event. So it's not just about paperwork. It's actually about doing it right so the actual event runs right, right? Does that make sense?
There's a lot of that. You know, there's a lot of that, and there's a lot of concern about that. And, you know, really, for some, you know, it goes both ways because you really hope that at the end of the day, no one gets a mic and just takes it and swears down it, you know? You know, another classic is like whenever they see the camera that they stick their middle finger up, you know. All these things were concerns before we did this. You know, what if someone just gets a mic and just swears obscenities down it? Like, it's going to take us time to find out what mic that person's on, if we can even, you know, narrow it down to what mic they're on. You know, there's so many channels, we can't, you know, we can't manage all of them in real time, and this is a real time event that's unfolding. You know, but none of these things happened, you know, I mean, you know, they there was actually a rumor that Orange were going to send down, you know, like 30 witches to the event. And then people were like, well, we can't stop them coming in, but they're all going to be there advertising Orange at our event. And then, you know, the head of Saatchi's, well, one of the head creatives at Saatchi's, Paul, said, well, that's great. Let them in. You know, nothing better than showing life for sharing than the fact that there's an entire second telecommunications company coming down to join in. And he was completely right. You know, if you sort of take that approach and you don't take that sort of standoffish, how do we stop this from happening, and you just sort of be wholehearted about it and say, well, yeah, fine, that's great. You know, if they want to join in, let them join in. Look, and if they end up on camera, that's fine. You know,
we often talk about clients and stuff, but you touched on it before, but to pull this off, you must have had actually the T-Mobile marketing exec guys not being your average, you know, oh, I'm a bit nervous about this. I mean, because you wouldn't have had time if they'd been fussing, and you must have had tremendous support from them.
Yeah, T-Mobile have been incredible. Much easier for them this time around. But the first time around, you're asking them to do something that really there's no precedence for. You know, you can't say, oh, look, it worked really well when so-and-so, you know, went out on a limb and did this. You know, and they were booking huge slabs of airtime. You know, like a 3-minute time slot. You're taking up an entire ad break. You know, these are not small commercials. I mean, the events aren't small, but even just the media buys of what you're asking are huge.
Wasn't there a 4-minute roadblock on Britain's Got Talent that they bought for the?
They actually aired a 2-minute version, but the 4-minute version is the real cut. So the 4-minute version is online, and the 4-minute version will be at the cinemas. They also ran the full 3-minute version, both on TV for dance and at cinemas. So you know they're all finished, you know, true HD 444, so that obviously putting them to film looks great, you know. And yeah, it's just, I don't know. It's one of those things. I think as a director, you get these opportunities where a client, an agency, and a production company comes together, and they've all got the same objective of just doing something really great. And instead of fighting each other, they have a great deal of respect. You know, the T-Mobile for Saatchi and Saatchi, and the fact that they got involved. Saatchi and Saatchi for Partizan and what they bring to the table. And for me, you know, obviously working with Rick and Steve on dance with Ashley, on both projects with Diesel, you know, these are people, particularly Diesel and Ashley, who we just collaborate on so many things and we have done now for so many years that you just get a shorthand in terms of the way you work.
Yeah.
So I can be here talking to you, knowing that we're right up against the deadline in the next suite, but Diesel's in there cutting, so I've got no worries in the world as to, you know, what's coming together. Well, you know, it's like, you know, you just have a very, you know, for me as a director, you're at the end of the day, you're just a conductor, you know, and you're surrounded by all these incredible musicians, And, you know, without them, you're just a guy waving a stick in the air. So, you know, who's interested in seeing that? Yeah, but with them, you know, with them, you can create things like dance and sing along. And, you know, for a moment in time, you can make a difference to, you know, millions of people.
Well, I understand exactly what you're saying, and yet also, having worked with you, I know your enthusiasm and energy on a project that kind of basically carries the entire team along. So I hope that not only does it, as it has, you know, find a huge kind of response in the, but I, you know, I hope that the creatives and the company are rewarded, and that, because this kind of creative advertising and thinking outside the box is, you know, is what it should be about. And so hopefully that'll go well for the brand, and then go well at Cannes, I'm sure. Hey, Mike, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us, man. We really appreciate it.
Pleasure, Mike Seymour. you know, for me, it's always a thrill to talk to a power user. I never made it to a power user myself, unfortunately.
Yes, but you did.
I still jump on Flame every now and then. I was on Flame just like literally on the last job I did.
Cool. Well, we look forward to catching up with you again next time we're in London. See you, mate.
True, mate. I'll see you then.
Well, thanks, guys. I think it's really great how so much of the stuff we do here on FX Guide, FX PhD, and now our new podcast that we've had out for a little while now, like 30-some-odd episodes, Red Center, all kind of ties together. Michael Gracie talked a bit about shooting some of the Liverpool train station with the SI-2K camera that was used in backpacks. And we just did one of the most recent Red Center podcasts, spoke with the DP. Mike talked to the DP from Slumdog Millionaire about the shooting with that camera and how the production problems that they had with that camera. So it's just interesting to get the multiple perspectives on people's experiences working with these new evolving formats. And if you haven't checked out Red Center and you have any interest in digital cinematography in general, I mean, it's obviously focused on the red, but it tends to get into a lot of broad issues having to do with the workflow that's evolving that we're all dealing with. You know, colorists are dealing with a lot more digital images as opposed to film, and it's happening the same for visual effects. It's a swing that's happening very rapidly. So Red Center kind of covers all those issues. Mike Seymour and Jason Wingrove do a fairly regular podcast with some length and in-depth coverage of the workflow issues, particularly right now they're doing a workflow series. So I would recommend, if you have interest in the production side or the post issues having to do with digital cinematography in general, check out the Red Center podcast. You can find it on the FX Guide homepage. There's a link. It's also on iTunes, and you can find it there. So anyway, check that out. Well, thanks for joining us, and until next time, I'm Jeff Huser. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you next time.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2008 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.